In the digital reality, evolution over revolution prevails. The QA approaches and techniques that worked yesterday will fail you tomorrow. So free your mind. The automation cyborg has been sent back in time. TED speaker Jonathan Wright's mission is to help you save the future from bad software.
Hey, and welcome to the show. Today I've got Joe Trickus, who's going to talk to us all about shifting left and the importance of getting that testing mindset. So welcome to the show, Joe.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Ah, it's fantastic to have you, and you're on day one of your isolation?
Day three. Oh, wait, is it Thursday? Oh, it's day four. We did a trial day on Monday, which just turned into let's not go back into that building. I've been on lockdown for 4 days now.
And how are you coping with the enterprise collaboration and doing stand-ups and you know, just carrying on BAU?
I've got to be honest, I think that in a month, if this is still ongoing, we're going to look at that office bill and be like, what are we spending our money on? Because it's relatively seamless, right? I mean, that's the advantage of being in the software field as well. We have the opportunity to just decide to not go into the office. Generally speaking, I personally am struggling slightly, but from an organizational health perspective, it's feeling like... generally speaking, people are coping. I'm intrigued, though, as to the impact this is likely to have on overall software quality, which obviously is going to be a key focus of both my role and this talk. So,
absolutely. And, you know, I must admit, my favourite film of all time is The Net. And I don't know if you've seen The Net with Sandra Bullock.
I've not, no.
There you go. You've got something to do when you've got a few days extra. So, you know, this is a 90s movie where she's a software tester, right? And she's working. She works from home. You know, let's just put it where she gets the latest build coming through on floppy disk. And she's testing from what I can see as Doom, which ironically is coming out tomorrow, right? The new Doom game. But the thing is, you know, when I watched that for the first time, I was like, that's the job I want. And that was before I even started, you know. This was kind of me at college and, yeah, having a bit of crush on Sandra Bullock. And, you know, part of it was, I was like, God, that's such a dream job. You know, you stay at home, you test games, you know, you raise bugs. She'd found this bug, which actually was a backdoor to money laundering and all this extra money, which is, you know, totally wild. But then, you know, she ends up, you know, people are following her, trying to kill her. And you know how these kind of, you know, blockbusters go. Yeah. Do you feel that that's your kind of role that's kind of happened to you since you kind of started? I know you started out at for a utilities company back in 2008.
Yeah, 2008 was when I was moved into their IT function. I mean, so to speak to that as sort of my journey over the last just shy of a decade in software testing, I was a typical, stereotypical almost tester in that I have to hold my hands up and say I did fall literally into testing to the extent I was just a bit of a diamond in the rough. I was in their customer service department. I was a real pain in the IT department's backside. They were at their point where they were just dipping the toe into the what then was termed the e-commerce world, which really was just having a website. It's just a SaaS website, basically, that you could log into and manage your meter readings and things. But it was new ground. And I was just in the right place at the right time to just naturally surface myself as someone with a technical capability. So I ended up sort of owning all of their prod bugs and being the business representative and eventually moving in as a trainee tester on their billing system, which was like that was a COBOL-based... we're going old school here, like a 70s-based system, which was actually now at this stage in my career, I look back at that and I'd actually argue being that close to the CPU and assembly has given me a much deeper respect, I would argue, for the precision that development engineers need to ensure. And I would argue, like, sort of ensures I'm cognizant, at least, of the number of transformation layers, high level languages go through to get to execute on a CPU. And then you consider the modern paradigm where the CPU is not even in the same, possibly even in the same continent as you. And yeah, we're existing within very complex systems at the moment. So it's, yeah, started basic there. And then that would be SSE for you.
Yeah, I remember a fantastic... So I used to work in Portsmouth for Zurich Insurance.
Oh, it was really? My
back in the 90s, it was one of my first load runner gigs, right? And, you know, it was a fascinating place to work and live. But I actually then went down the road to Southampton to another utilities company. I forget what their name is. I don't think it was SSE. But anyway, we had this really interesting issue that, and I don't know if you've come across this in the same industry, but there was this cloud of that smelt like gas, and then they had a huge amount of call center numbers coming through, and it kept on bringing down the customer service platform, because actually it wasn't gas, it was just some kind of freak thing that had come over from France, and everyone
remember
kept on
that
smelling
event.
It
I remember yeah. it yeah I remember that event. So it probably was SSE, because certainly the Hampshire in general, from a generational and distribution perspective, is completely managed by SSE's distribution business. So their sort of emergency service center. So it was interesting actually how my career did sort of go full circle, in that I started my career in the SSE's retail arm, adding a testing capability to their billing system, and then over the years moved through various places and ended up at GE Power, where I was responsible for So they have a product called Power on Advantage, which is literally, it is the software that runs the power grids, the national grids of entire economies. So that was amazing. A really lot of responsibility in that software. And there were points where the software that I was then responsible for, there was an incident, I'm pretty sure it was early last year, where there was an outage across most of the United Kingdom for about 40 minutes. Now, if this outage management software that I was previously responsible for wasn't in place, that seriously could have just ground the entire electricity grid to a halt. That software is literally the software I used to see the emergency service center representatives using when they were on the phone to people phoning up saying, oh my gosh, I can smell gas, what's going on? And that would have all the maps of where all the stuff is, without exposing too much about that particular package. So it was quite a romantic idea that I did end up going sort of full circle from their chain of value.
Well, GE are just a legend. You know, I've seen literally when we started talking about, you know, everyone started talking about digital transformation, GE Power was literally the go-to kind of company for kind of IoT, for visualization. I remember seeing this amazing data visualization of all of the grid systems all connected in together. It was absolutely, mm-hmm. you know, they were the best in class. And it was quite interesting because we were doing the same kind of thing. So I was at Hitachi at the time, and we were doing, you know, nuclear power stations. So Fusion Horizon, which was based out in Gloucester, you know, we were actually building nuclear power stations and doing testing strategy for how you test them. And, you know, that always worries me when you're doing things like, you know, nuclear power. And then it's like, how do you put testing around that, and how do you do that in kind of a 1 week sprint is a kind of an interesting one. But yeah, and then we went out to Australia, and there was a really interesting one around there, because 90% of bushfires, which obviously they've just had last year, are caused by downed power lines. So they were wanting to utilize our visualization platform to kind of understand if there was any anomalies on the power grid, and then potentially go off and investigate them, because obviously there's huge distances between land masses. And so it is kind of, well, okay, you know, this predictive platform, so things like SLAM, so your predictive maintenance platforms, could kind of obviously predict when, you know, there's a potential weather which is going to impact, you know, these lines. And it's so complex, but I don't think most people see that level of complexity. You know, do you find that when you were in the utilities area and you were doing this kind of you know, critical systems. You know, your thought process for QA was completely different to maybe what it is now with a smaller, you know, startup company.
I'd say it's a bit of a yes and no response, because in particular where I'm at now, we are dealing with a mass scheduling challenge. So at Aerts, we provide sort of scheduling software to, at the moment, the accountancy firms is what we're focused on, primarily due to our CEO previously being an accountant, so he knows that industry very thoroughly. But the key idea behind the business was to actually spin out a bunch of artificial intelligence research that our CTO was working on at University of Strathclyde. So in terms of complexity, the power grid runs in a fundamentally linear fashion, and they'll be segregated by various sort of substations, that's the word, there you go, it came to me. But effectively, you can envision it as big serial rings. So from that perspective, there can be visual complexity, but from a physical perspective, it can actually be a bit more simple than the more novel sort of SaaS products that we're just starting to be able to build. I mean, Aerts is a company, I was employee 14, we're up to 36 now, a year later, so we've grown fast. And just the way we're able to leverage novel research in AI means for such a small number of people, we're able to schedule the work for 100,000 individuals down to a 15-minute granularity. So if you imagine 37 and a half hours a week times 100,000 people times four, effectively, that's the sort of chunks of time, the number of chunks of time we're dealing with. Then you consider that the whole concept is real-time scheduling. So at any point in time, any change in that overall shape of resource availability means all other factors need to be, like all other existing schedules need to be considered. So it's, so there's some of this stuff sort of happening in the energy industry, especially in particular with sort of outage management, because the legislation these days is so hard on, or depending on your country, obviously, I think California and some of the Western states in America suffer a little bit from lacking this legislation. But fundamentally, in the UK, more than 10,000 people without power for about 10 minutes. I can't remember the exact regulations clipping out the industry a couple of years, but it's not a very long amount of time if you were in a traditional model where you needed to identify the issue, get that information to an electrical engineer, have them travel there, resolve it, get everyone back on. Having some measure of soft AI, some ability to make a safety conscious decision and empower a human being to click that button with confidence that no one's going to get vaporized as a result of it, and that's effectively what we're talking about here, right? Like the outage management system could involve clicking a button on a mouse that results in a 144,000 volt switch switching. And anything downstream from that that's in contact is going to have a very bad time. Oh. That person needs to have confidence in the software that they're able to do that. But fundamentally, the actual scheduling, is it in a concept, you could see it as a scheduling problem. It's like a temporal schedule of where's the power going to be at what point in time, and are there any humans that should be in contact with it? If not, you've got a green button. Click your mouse, I'll switch the switch, and that street will have power again. And then obviously the next iteration is removing the human from that loop, which is the challenge of the energy industry, I would say, is to have a seamless, global, sustainable national grid, or, well, international grid, I'd say, eventually. But that's me getting all blue sky.
it's definitely not blue sky. One of the first most scary days of my life was going into the Horizon nuclear power offices and literally sitting down with the CTO, and I was like, well, what are your top five things? Obviously safety, you know, the normal kind of things popped up, and then he talked about drones, and this was probably 5 years ago, and the idea of drones was a bit out there. And, you know, he was like, yeah, I need two of your team to become, you know, be able to, you know, do their drone flight certifications. And obviously the legislation in the UK means that you can only pilot a drone which is looking into your own land. So you have to fly it kind of backwards all the way around. And, you know, part of it was exactly that, is they wanted to use near field. They wanted to use, you know, IoT, that if there was, you know, they need to go and look at a system, you know, it would be able to interact with that using a drone instead of sending it a human to go there. And, you know, the same thing was, you know, the next item was down was no buttons, right? You know, you always go into these power grids and there's just, you know, thousands of controls. Yeah. The idea was, you know, you don't need that because, you know, that, you know, I remember Homer, that was the great thing about Homer, sat there waiting for that button that he needed to press, and then, you know, he'd never press it, would he? You know, part of it is that's kind of, you know, adding a level of human augmentation, which you don't really need. But it's fascinating what you're talking about, because we had a similar kind of problem. So we were doing, I don't know if you've heard of Startwerker in Germany, but they're, you know, part of what Germany are doing is they're trying to use just renewables. So we'd had, you know, a bit of a spec, which we must admit, it's probably one of the hardest testing tasks I've ever done, which was, you know, we want to be able to predict the amount of power that's going to get used on the grid, and also predict the amount of energy that's going to be generated by renewables. But of course, how do you do this? And I know GE was the example that we came to, we actually used, and it was, so they were using predictive weather and you know, information, historical information from AccuWeather from, you know, the last 5 years or whatever it was, and they were able to kind of understand based on a wind turbine what potentially how much wind would be there for a solar panel, which we were making both the wind turbines and solar panels, you know, how much electricity it would get. And then on the opposite side of the time was around how much would be taken from the grid. So okay, football or sporting events have been cancelled now, but you know, they could pretty much understand how much was getting pulled. And then what they wanted to do, which is kind of sounds like what you're doing at the moment with this scheduling, is they wanted to be able to buy and sell electricity within a 15-minute window. And and the whole point of this was to be able to sell, you know, a small percentage 24 hours before, but actually be able to sell it as people are wanting to be able to pull it. So in California, as you mentioned, people like air conditioning units would negotiate with a broker platform for clean energy at a certain price, and then they would pull that in based on the fact that they know that they're going to switch on in 30 minutes, so they need to source the power. And, you know, to me, that just, you know, it's crazy because, you know, obviously you can't have wind turbines in your test lab. So, you know, everything's an IoT device, which means you then need to also, you know, you need to think about things like service virtualization, but then service virtualization for 10,000 wind turbines, all with different energy signatures coming out. And, you know, you send a REST request to say, start power up, and then it, you start seeing different outputs based on the amount of, you know, wind that's coming through. To then get those 10,000, you know, different streams of information coming back into the virtual power station to then, you know, emulate that actually by selling, buying and selling in those kind of 50-minute windows, they'd be able to generate an extra, you know, 8% revenue or whatever it was. You know, those models are incredibly complex. They're probably, most people who are out there on the call are thinking, you know, combining your expertise within GE Power and SSE, you know, all your kind of utilities plus this scheduling capability, and then on top of that kind of AI, you know, these challenges are real and they're also incredibly complex. So how do you go about, you know, establishing that kind of QA capability within a startup which has got such big ambitions?
Sure. So day one, when I certainly when I started, so where to start really? The interview, I guess, is where it all starts, right? When you first meet the team, it was really important for me to discuss that they were recruiting for a software test engineer, which I've basically trended towards the mind model that's an anti-pattern, but even the concept of naming test as a distinct function immediately absolves responsibility of certain upstream functions. So this was one of the first sort of messages I was endeavoring to bang to the board at the time when they were sort of looking to take me on. So Yeah, I ended up getting hired by them, and my role ended up being software quality engineer, and that was really part of trying to just shift. Obviously, test and quality assurance have both existed in the paradigm of software engineering for the last like 2 decades, but certainly it just felt like a distinguishing factor anyway, a way to shift the narrative. Maybe it was more about me in hindsight, but long story short, the key for me was to pitch to the development engineers a vision of what is the ultimate development engineer. So the absolute, like the 100x, the what we sometimes refer to as the unicorn engineer. So the true full stack, capable of having some measure of DevOps capability so they can, and infrastructure capability so they can stand up their environments, write the code, which is the existing sort of job spec, but then also write all of the, or at least contribute to the ancillary sort of projects you'd have on the go to validate the main code base. So that was the sort of mantra that I was walking in with, was to empower every development engineer to be able to do the whole thing. In theory, they should be able to go home, stand up some VM somewhere or some app server, build their own app, fully functionally test it, fully integration test it. Obviously, that would all take a lot of time. The other caveat, or not caveat, but the other reality is businesses, you never join a business with a clean blank slate and a blank check and no prior commitments. So the other challenge was we had so much business already planned. So effectively, I ended up focusing independently on building out sort of an automation framework to basically spearhead that and mitigate our need to get hundreds of testers, because as I just described, sort of the complexity of the software to actually manually functionally test it would be, it would triple our business in terms of test resource. So yeah, it's just not feasible to do that in the short term, really, or desirable, to be honest, in the long term, because manual testing as a role is not well suited to human beings.
Very kind of very good at kind of, you know, being, you know, doing testing, not really checking. So, you know, you're a big advocate for this kind of shift left approach. You know, what do you mean by shift left, and how do you go about doing that?
So there are some, certainly, so the first step you can take to shift left is to ensure people of a test with a testing capability are involved at the earliest possible stage of the discussion of a change, whatever that change might be, if it's a bug or a ticket or tech debt resolution, and whatever it might be, having someone that has a demonstrable capability in exploring the real fringes and the edge cases of a problem, having them in there at early doors can help. Now, it's important to sort of ensure that's scoped, like that conversation needs, it's very easy to sort of continuously pull potential problems from the ether. So it does need to be scoped within the context of the business risks and the outcomes your business needs. But I'd say that's the first step, is just having that. Then the next step is to proliferate that mindset, so it's not just a capability within a subset of people. And that can sometimes be the biggest challenge, because not everyone wants that skill set, which I would say is a problem in itself. That's like an institutional or organizational challenge. But from my perspective, I've been really lucky, because everyone that I work with is super interested. They really admire sort of the ability of that. What it's named, the testing mindset. When you do the ISEV course in the UK, you stumble across a concept called professional skepticism, which I think is the most succinct way of describing that testing mindset. It's the concept of just assuming I operate under the sort of axiom that every assumption will result in a failure. So at any point in the process, from what already exists to what we wish to bring into existence, any assumption from A to B will result in some sort of unplanned work, run over, which inevitably results in a compromise of quality. So that for me is the key. It's all about over communication of assumptions. And that is an ego problem, right? So we suddenly stumble into, I've got this background as a technical functional tester, and now actually I'm effectively providing like an ego check to people to say, actually, this is a psychologically safe environment. It's perfectly fine for you to be honest about the things you're assuming. Some of them might be fallacies, and we can discuss that, and we can ensure we're all operating from the same viewpoint. But in my experience, the key to shifting left, setting aside functional automation test frameworks and API test frameworks, all that stuff, is the real squishy human bit, which is, do I feel safe telling everyone that was my commit? I introduced that bug that caused X damage. When I deliberate on that, it's most likely due to this assumption that if it had been raised at this point one in the whole process, we may well have mitigated. We may not have, but the point being, I would say 95% of issues that make it through at some point are as a result of an assumption.
I think that kind of, you know, assumptions are really difficult, isn't it? You know, in the good old days, you'd be starting, you know, requirements engineering, you'd be understanding, you know, that you shouldn't have should, could, and would, and, you know, you'd go through and you'd say that's a bit ambiguous. You know, so do you find that you're capturing things from when people talk about a concept or an idea? Are you kind of validating those very quickly and then kind of, you know, justifying them, the architecture, justifying the decisions that are made, being involved at every part of that process? Is that kind of something that you feel is a kind of a role of a QA engineer?
Yes. To be succinct, yes. I would say, yeah, certainly from the quality engineering perspective. So that was the second mantra that I sort of, that I was beating my drum to, was my objective was to engineer a process that results in a quality product. So not to say, how do we take this existing process and ensure, augment it, keep it fundamentally the same and augment it to result in an increase in quality. Like, to me, that is quality is a, you have to start with quality in order to get quality out at the end. And to me, that is the first hurdle is assumption. I would say the analogy I used in a lunch and learn at ETS, which I think does resonate quite nicely with this conversation, is, you know, modern science, we don't have to redo the original experiments that validated the presence of a force called gravity. We don't have to redo that every time we embark on a new experiment that's at a deeper level of understanding with respect to that concept, because we have explored it, we have documented it, we've observed it, and most importantly, we have confidence in basic checks that validate it's still a present variable. So I can just pick up my mouse and drop it on my desk and I know gravity's still there, right? I don't need to do all of the subtle all the crazy experiments that have happened in order to validate that. So that is what I would say, the way in order to, it's safe to have assumptions as long as you have checks in place that provide you feedback as to any change in that variable, which is where test automation becomes really valuable, because you can have assumptions about a feature in your product as long as you can get realistic, valid, and believable feedback as to whether your assumptions have been invalidated.
Absolutely. And I know your previous role, you were very familiar with cloud infrastructure. You know, how do you find that building things on the cloud versus how you used to do things with on-prem? you know, do you find that it's a lot harder to see when you've got, you know, things like .NET Core and, you know, you can't access those kind of messaging layers as easily? Mm. You know, is there more challenges from an automation perspective now that you've got the cloud kind of scale?
So my current role at the moment, I also do deliver some support. So I am in the support rota with the developers. And certainly when you are traversing multiple networks to get into like a cloud-based network, you do lose some. Certainly, obviously, it just basically increases the latency. Like, there's no alternative to that. But just as well, as you say, you can lose. It can sometimes feel like you're flying blind a bit. If you don't have access to the same logs that you might see, you might not be able to remote into the VM, or it might not even be running on a VM. And so it might just be containerized and there's X number of instances. And yeah, I'd say like that is just part of the challenge of software engineering at this point. And in the same way that login would be something you'd ensure is written out to a hard drive, it adds a layer of complexity that has to just be addressed as early as possible, because it's so critical to the supportability of an application. There needs to be someone banging the drum of support, and it also does tie nicely into testability, as you mentioned, because you can be interrogating these logs as much as the front end, as much as the APIs, just to validate that it is operating exactly as you would expect.
I think that's actually really fascinating, because I occasionally should slap myself on the wrists and tell myself off for talking about things like ops dev, right? And you know, my view with ops dev is this kind of, well, you know, I really want to see operational staff involved with, you know, things like sprint planning, you know, being involved in the end state, so they can kind of say, okay, well, we've got to manage this, we need to be able to, you know, will these different platforms work in our end environment? How will we support them? How will we get the information? And what's, you know, from things like site reliability engineering and stuff like that. Now, actually, your background coming from the initial support side of things actually is more of a, you know, a support ops, you know, dev support, where you're actually looking at, well, if I find an issue with this in the production, and, you know, I'm dealing with something like ServiceNow to raise a ticket and then understand the criticality of it and then make it so that we're actually, you know, it feeds back. I need to have access to the logs. You know, I need, you know, if Prometheus is pulling out, you know, information on a container, I need to, you know, be able to have access to, you know, what's important from a monitoring perspective, you know, what's important from a performance perspective. You know, it's been really interesting to see just how many systems have gone down since in the COVID-19, you know, yesterday they launched that, you know, announced that Ocado are, you know, not only scrapping their mobile app, which, you know, I was sat there queuing on, and they said, oh yeah, we've got a really fair system which we're using to actually allow people to wait in a queue, which we knew they didn't really do or implement. And then they said, yep, the same thing's happened with the website. And then they've now admitted that actually technically the website and the mobile app suck, and therefore they're going to rewrite it and then, you know, put it back out. Now, we know that that's, you know, underlining is Waitrose. We know that's John Lewis. We know JLP, you know, I've done these things at scale before. So why is Ocado different, right? And, you know, GoToMeeting, I noticed three meetings now that I literally can't get on to GoToMeeting because it's gone down. You know, it's interesting how at times where we need to leverage these kind of cloud-based apps, which we know are cloud, and maybe haven't been architectured to scale, and, you know, that makes a real challenge, because what you're doing at the moment, you know, is that level of complexity like Zoom would do, like if you're, you know, you're doing Calendly to kind of connect into your online calendar. All of these are dependent on other upstream and downstream systems, of which if one of those fails, then there's systemic failure across the entire stack. You know, the ability to quickly do that and do a root cause analysis, pinpoint failure analysis, you know, requires access to what would you do if you were in support? How would you diagnose the problem? Mm. What are the steps you do? Well, I'd go and have a look at the log. I'd go on in as the user. You know, do you find that that insight that and that mentality that they've got has actually helped create much easier to maintain from a support perspective as well as, you know, an operational standpoint?
Yeah, definitely. I'd say building in space for people to literally walk into the shoes of another and be able to empathize with their pain is possibly the most effective way of addressing that gap. So actually building space into the engineering budget so that engineers can go, if you're in an organization of sort of the mid to large size, focused on software, you're probably going to have a support function that is your first or second tier support. I would argue it is a responsibility of development engineers to go and spend some time with those people to understand the pain that they encounter. And, you know, 95% of the time you'll find exactly what you just described. Like there'll be hidden nuggets of unplanned work that crop up all the time within that function that can just be engineered away if people know about it. Equally, situational awareness is so critical, right? Like having proactive monitoring so that you can actually foresee an issue come in and head it off, or at least do something proactively rather than, you know, everyone's queuing because we actually can't. I can't imagine what the actual technical issue was, but it guarantee it's something silly, like they just couldn't serve enough WebSockets or something. 95% of the time it is something minor like that, that you just, unless you're willing to actually ask the question at day one, you know, oh, we want to build this app and it may, what's the average usage? Oh, it's going to be approximately this level based on existing walk-in clients or whatever. And then what is the nth, what's the worst case scenario, which we're basically now in. It's that sort of being confident to name that. And it may just well be that someone did and the business just accepted, you know what, the risk is low given the low probability or frequency of this event. So we're just consciously not going to engineer quality in that domain. The problem is at this point, that really sucks for your reputation. So I think the other, that's one other element to this, is understanding how to communicate risk, and most importantly, risk to your business's reputation, because so much rests on that in this modern world.
And the brand damage is just, you know, it's not quantifiable. That's the problem, is that part of it is you don't write, as you're doing these planning, you look at business value. You can talk about the business value of having a mobile platform, but you don't really ever sit there with a ticket value of, well, from a brand perspective, if this system goes down for 3 hours, it's not only going to cost us X amount of million per hour in loss of revenue, but the brand damage means that we could see maybe a 20, 30% decrease of customer loyalty and return, you know, retention rate. And that could be something that just ends the company, right? You know, it's this kind of day where it's actually, you know, these kind of issues, these edge cases that maybe people did think about from an SRE perspective, but they kind of, they made it low risk. And part of it was maybe they were looking at this kind of fintech, retail tech kind of approach where actually, you know, we'll rely on other people's APIs, you know, we'll, you know, we don't need sandbox environments, you know, we'll have a live system, you know, and then they can't roll back. You know, they've got no real big DR strategy in there. They've not really done any of the chaos engineering aspects. You know, is this the door that opens chaos engineering to 2021? You know, have we just discovered it?
Well, chaos has turned up, right? Like, it's inevitable, I would argue, because some event is going to occur that is, we're in a globalized world now. We're sort of existing, we're still attached to old modes of working. Yeah, like we spoke briefly at the beginning about my personal struggle with transitioning to working from home because I've just never really needed to do it except for maybe out of hours releases, which were naturally just, you know, wait for your window, bring down the servers, deploy and check stuff, which is pretty easy to do, but to actually remain focused. But yeah, I'd say in terms of chaos engineering, we're starting now to get to the point of technological reliance where there's definitely space for more novel sort of chaos engines, whether it's like some sort of soft AI or machine learning based tool that you can just say, like, here is a URL or here is an IP, introduce chaos through various means. It definitely feels like, I know there are some tools within the scope of sort of cloud based solutions. It would be very interesting if I could get my hands on something that was a little bit more basically like a virtual hacker, but that can scale. Because this is the challenge, I think, is I'm sure there are white box tools, actually, that can start to lean on that. But certainly, that would be, yeah, interesting.
Well, that is, like when we first talked, you know, what I'm doing today is I'm running, I'm using Burp Suite, which is a security tool on Kali, which is a security penetration testing, platform. And I'm using the spider to transpose a website to get images off it for a customer. So the customer knows I'm on their site. I'm throttling it, so I've only got a certain amount of spiders there because I don't want to DDoS attack it. And I'm extracting those images so we can fill their, push them through our Tesla flow to see if it can recognize the images based on what we've been doing with identifying, different clothing brands and styles. So, this is a legitimate tool which I'm using, but, at the same time, this could be done to the opposite side of things of, well, and I know Flood.io, that since the COVID-19 have said, oh yeah, you can free to use our performance platform, but maybe those are the things you DDoS a DNS and see what happens. You bring down your Kafka or you bring down a certain amount of nodes on Kube or something, and you kind of go, okay, this can, as resiliency, it's able to spin them back up. We're not losing any information. We're not losing, anything critical. And, and I know your background, especially when you did the stuff with Sitekit, this ability to deal with multi-cloud. So, okay, we got a problem with Azure. We can't fix it, but we can deploy anywhere. We can put our Kube instance in AWS. We just remove everything and point the DNSs. Do you think, this idea of multi-cloud, and I know people call it mega cloud as well, which I don't know if that's just because they own a mega drive, but it was, this idea that they're able to move between cloud instances, they're able to move back on-prem if they need to with a reduced set of functionality just so that they can continue to keep the business up.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that even the concept, like we get quite wedded to the brand name that we're sort of paying for access to virtual CPUs, but fundamentally they are server racks, right? So like it is just an off-site server. So I'd say from a technical, like first principles perspective, there really isn't much separating the various clouds. Obviously they have their own internal capabilities and they can sort of manage different types of traffic. But at the raw CPU level, you're effectively buying CPU cycles. So from that perspective, definitely. But the key being, you need to explore it because they do have their own requirements in terms of how certain things are configured and deployed. I do think that's generally standardizing now, though, which is good. I'd say that we're at an interesting crossroads where the sheer level of distributed computing power, like just based on modern smartphones, is already orders of magnitude greater than the fastest supercomputers. Even, I don't know the exact number, I've not sat and done these numbers, so this is just my mind extrapolating from what I've seen. But I imagine you don't have to go far back for the current distributed smartphone network to easily rival the top supercomputers in the world. I'd say 5 years or so. If you're looking at like the iPhone 11s and the top line Samsung flagship phones, etc., if you wired all them up, the point I'm making is I'm pretty sure cloud will be relatively short-lived, like from a long-term species perspective, in the same sense that if you look at the Industrial Revolution, all right, it was 100-odd years, and we're just watching the timelines compound in terms of our leaps in technology. This feels like a stopgap to me to facilitate much more distributed computing. So it's interesting you mentioned Sitekit, where we were working on a self-sovereign identity platform for a large payments provider, which really was the concept of binding your passport, your driving license, your national insurance number to the Face ID scan on your phone. So you no longer need to carry them documents. You can board a plane by unlocking your phone. That was really interesting. And it's happening and it's coming. And that's a circumstance where actually the cloud computing component, other than some cryptographic transforms, which are just getting more and more efficient as time proceeds, is mostly done on your mobile device. So, you know, there's not even the level to which that could augment society compared to its relative cloud reliance is actually quite incredible, compared to sort of some of the leading SaaS products that we're seeing. So I love cloud. It's been a huge revolution in terms of the capability it delivers to software engineers. I'd say that the speed at which you can go from having nothing, just an idea, to an implementation running in a different country with, you know, your basic hot swaps, your backups, all done just with a click of a button. The way that it's reduced that, reduced the latency between an idea and an MVP is awesome. But yeah, I would say looking forwards, I mean, I'm talking like the 10-year horizon here, but I'd be really surprised if we're still building huge data centers that are driving most processing. But yeah,
I've got to agree with the one of the predictions I made a couple of years ago was, you know, people start bringing things back on prem. You know, there's only so much compute power you need. And, you know, when I was at Hitachi, HDS was made physical kit, right? And that physical tin, they were using, was UCP. So it was a unified compute platform, which meant that, yes, you got 192, you know, cores, physical cores, but, and, you know, maybe 192 gigabytes of data of RAM. But, you know, it was enough to kind of do SAP HANA. It was enough to kind of use for whatever you wanted. You could, you know, spin up as much VMs or Docker or whatever containerization you needed. There's enough power there. Now, you know, the question about having giving it to somebody else's data center is, well, and the point you've just made about the side of things of edge devices, you know, the new iPhone, I think they're calling it 11 Pro Max or whatever it is, you know, it's got, you know, 6 gig of RAM on it, you know, and it's got, you know, quad core, you know, it's, you know, these, you know, the Xboxes, you know, are pretty much just supercomputers now. Your Tesla outside has X amount of GPUs and CPUs that you could use. Now, I'm not saying move the device form to your car, but I'm also not saying why not? Because at the end of the day, if I can run, you know, Kali on a Raspberry Pi for $40, then I know that my Tesla outside is going to be have even more power and more GPU power because it has to do computer vision. It has to recognize when people are stepping out on the road. So, you know, I could, and it runs on Linux. You know, is there any reason why I can't just load up my my stack on there, right? And that's the big question. And then all I need to do is a bit like Azure do with their big data farms, which are just containers they stick on the back of lorries, is all I need to do is just plug it into water water, or in this case, electricity, but yeah. electricity, water, Ethernet, and yeah, I've got my mobile data center. So, you know, if edge devices are really getting that powerful, you know, why not is the big question. And I think this is, you know, we joke, but at the same time, you know, this ML on both the Android platform and Apple platform, you know, the Windows have been talking about WinML for a long time, which is 2019 onwards, which is predefined machine learning stuff, which, you know, you could go off the easy example with that one is go into PowerPoint, load PowerPoint, put any image you want, right-click on it, go to alt text. It's, you know, it's already trained to say the image you've just done is a picture of a kitten sat next to a lake. You know, that stuff is kind of, you know, done to death. So, you know, I do see some really interesting opportunities of, you know, well, how do you make those decisions on architecture? How easy can you switch between it? You know, what are those technical challenges where you're wanting, like what you're doing, you know, being able to, you know, do 15-minute windows, you know, that's the kind of criticality now is, you know, what kind of IOPS do you need? You know, I was talking to somebody last week in France before the quarantine and while I was there, and he was saying that he saw this great YouTube video where there's a guy shouting at a new disk drive, and because of the frequency of our voice, it actually made the IOPS drop. So it went slower. So it's a bit like with like talking to plants, you know, they need oxygen. You know, are we going to be there wanting to actually have physical tin so we can shout at it and actually make an impact on some of the testing? But, you know, it's been absolutely fantastic chatting to you. And you know, we could literally chat, and I think we should. I think literally come day 25 or something, or 28 days later, we'll come back and we'll see you rocking backwards and forwards going, what, you know, all the websites will be gone down, you know, no one will be able to buy food because, you know, they just, you know, their apps, you know, just didn't scale in the cloud. They thought, oh no, it'd be fine, you know, we'll use the same architecture, we'll just stick it in AWS, it'll be fine. Nobody will ever know until COVID-19, so... So anyways, so just in kind of closed, you know, how's the best way to get, you know, people who are listening to get in touch with you, or, you know, do you have anything, you know, any links, blogs and stuff that you can share with us, or, you know, LinkedIn, what's the best way to reach out to you?
So the best two platforms would likely be Twitter or LinkedIn. You can email me directly, joetrickus@gmail.com. Why not? Like, it's just, yeah. So certainly, if people want to get in touch, do feel free. I will also be cheeky, if you don't mind, and just briefly plug an idea I'm co-founding at this point in time, which I think would be of great interest to you, especially given your exposure to nuclear power plants.
Bring it on.
So it's a concept called WithU, which is a device and a platform. The device plugs into existing light sockets and provides infrared and visual spectrum real-time feeds for users of augmented reality and VR devices. So the concept is effectively like a VoIP call, but I'm coining it presence over IP. And the idea is effectively you can step into someone's real-time environment. So like this podcast, for example, I own a Vive, and if you had one of these devices installed, I could with you, which is the sort of term I'm looking to try and coin as this concept. And I would be sat next to you in real time. I could see your screen. I could see the spiders crawling all over your browser. So I'm actually co-founding that now. We've got a prototype that we're in the process of building with my co-founder. And I just wish I'd done this 2 months ago so that when this propped up, everyone just had virtual offices. So I just thought I'd chuck that out there. It's a very interesting concept. And certainly, if anyone's listening and they find that idea appealing, get in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you have a website or a Kickstarter page or anything we can promo?
Not going to lie, this is legit stealth mode still. I just thought I'd tell you because it like resonates so closely with the discussion about the nuclear drone, the drones in the nuclear power plant. Like, it's a use case that I've been looking at. We're in stealth mode to the extent that we want to get a physical prototype built. There's no digital media to consume other than this 2 minute mention of it on a podcast. It will be coming, but the key for me is that there's actually something physical and demonstrable, so I just wanted to plug it at the very end. I think you might see my name floating about.
Well, I will, you know, I'll make an intro as well. So when I did my TED talk, the guy before me did a HoloLens TED talk, and it was really interesting because what he did was for the American football over in the States. So the guys could wear a HoloLens, Microsoft HoloLens headset, and then do reps. So they could, you know, they instead of having everyone on a team, you know, training 24 hours a day, throw the ball, let's see what this formation is, let's see what happens if someone breaks through there. You could literally do it virtually. So you could have other teammates playing at the same time. Great demo. I'll make sure I link you to, because he's a VR MR guy.
Yeah,
I think the idea is absolutely fantastic, because that co-working aspect of having with me, you know, as you're saying, you know, gives you that kind of capability to actually sit down, do some peer programming, you know, look at the same screen, you know, do those interactions that actually we still want. So, yeah, fantastic. And as we're plugging, my latest web domain that I purchased is covid.fo. And I'm trying to work out what FO stands for, or could potentially be an abbreviation for. But I don't think it's a startup company, but I definitely think it's a cool domain to have. I did previously register don'tassumemygender.com, but that didn't seem to make as much thing. But corona.fo definitely might get some traction with the idea of once it's disappeared. But yeah.
I mean, I can think of an abbreviation of FO or 4FO that succinctly it surmises my attitude towards COVID quite nicely, but
well, free emails for all is what I'm saying. So if you want a free covid.fo domain email, I will make sure it redirects to your Gmail for you and anybody else who wants it on the show. So there you go. I've just, you know, found a use for it. So anyway, Joe, it's been an absolute pleasure. You know, best of luck with COVID-19, and yeah, let's save the world from making bad decisions about cloud infrastructure.
Absolutely. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.